I would say that that really fanned the flames of my of my existing kind of activist mindset and like orientation towards social justice. I went to school in St. Louis through Catholic schools, and service and justice have always been a part, I felt like, of educational upbringing I had. But I also thought that going to college and actually getting exposed to like how these ideas kind of fit together and like not necessarily thinking of things as simple as like charity and philanthropy, you know, but also like the economic factors at play and the sociopolitical climates that make change easier or keep people oppressed. You know, I mean, there are so many issues that come into play. And again, agriculture just feels like it's bound up in all those things.
Welcome to Tangled Taproot, where we explore the unique stories of small-scale farmers in the Midwest. I'm Kristen.
And I'm John.
I'm Jackson.
And this is a production of Milk and Hummus.
What is Milk and Hummus?
Well, we make flavorful hummus and ready-to-drink plant-based lattes that focus on locally sourced ingredients, sustainable packaging, and the humble chickpea. In this episode, we're very excited to talk about Earth Dance Farms with the CEO and owner, Molly Rockaman. We would say this is probably one of the most famous operating farms in the St. Louis area that is widely known and recognized by a lot of folks in the community, because not only is it a significant sized piece of land growing a lot of produce, it's also organic. And that is an exciting thing for the St. Louis community. And finally, I would say because it is a farm teaching school, that sets it apart from everything else. And they are on the map.
Yes, they are. And boy, have they come a long way. Listening to this interview, I mean, they started in 2008. That was the stock market crash. But they stuck it out and they did their thing. They didn't really have a lot of experience, just a love for farming and nature. And I feel like they had everything going against them. She said that they had the old tractor. They had no experience. They had no irrigation.
No water.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
Having to like fill up these barrels of water and then bringing them to there just to do that.
Yeah. That.
And they kept going.
Dedication. Really nitty gritty. Obviously, just passionate enough to drive them forward through those pull yourself up by the bootstraps type of times when people said maybe it's time to give up, and they pushed on through, and now they've made quite the name for themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've all been there. We've been to their Farmer Formal, which was an incredible event, which you'll hear more about in the interview.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the story. So Earth Dance is officially acknowledged as being the oldest organic farm west of the Mississippi, which should maybe make your jaw drop a little bit to acknowledge that and hear that. And it's located in the heart of Ferguson. It's an intricately woven story, really, because the initial seed for Molly's inspiration and joy and just kind of seeking earthbound things and seeds and the freshness of growing your own produce, that seed was planted for her as a young girl.
Right, for sure.
And I think it's kind of a fun facet of the story to know that her dad took her there when she was a child because he knew that she loved veggies.
Right.
And so she actually got to visit the farm long before this story was even written.
Right, absolutely. And there were like you said, it's just like very intricate and like finely woven. I mean, had she not gone through or seen and done all the things that she did, who knows like if this farm would exist. But you know, she talked about the time that she spent in Africa, and she talked about the time
she's
in California
farms. Yeah.
Right, absolutely, where she did her apprenticeship. And I think that all of that just like came together and like made the perfect thing, and it that's why this farm is so successful and why this farm is doing as well as it is.
There's a lot of heart behind it. And yeah, it was a long journey. It kind of a roundabout way to end up getting to where Molly ended up in pursuing her passion.
Just the whole idea of establishing a school is also something that's really different and unique. It's not so much, hey, we're gonna have produce, we're gonna have this and this crop. The whole concept behind education and wanting to expand the capabilities of the neighborhood and community so that they can also have an interest in and grow and develop.
And through their wide network of dedicated volunteers, they've been able to grow and add on additional rows and bits of the farm through the years. And because of that growth and excess, they've been able to establish a pay what you can farm stand, which they're fairly well known for.
Yeah.
And that's like a wonderful gift to the neighborhood and community and anybody that can get there. But also they're able to have enough produce to show up at assorted farmers markets throughout the region too, to sell their produce.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. I think she even mentioned they like go into schools and teach children even.
Yeah, like a little garden in the classroom.
Right, absolutely. You'll hear this in an interview, but she was talking about how the younger kids, they're more interested in like the cooking aspect. But if you get them when they're young about like cooking, oh, how do I make this with like these organic ingredients? Then as they get older, the seed is already planted. And so that they have more questions about, oh, where do we even get this? And where does this come from? And then there you go. And then next you know, you're signing up for their farmer's apprenticeship, which is something that they offer, which I thought was really cool as well.
Yeah, lots of programming that they've developed extensively through the years to really just broaden that educational outreach component that is, yeah, just a really beautiful, unique feature of this farm.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the farm itself, again, lifts up the entire neighborhood of Ferguson and the surrounding area, not just based off the produce, but also the knowledge that these interns or volunteers can obtain. And then
say there's a lot of successful graduates on the scale of farming that have come out of the Earth Dance Farm School and started some iteration of their own business with plants or growing or produce, and have been able to make a name for themselves. And some of those are folks that you might be familiar with, and some that we buy produce from ourselves.
There was at one point in the interview, the end of the interview, Molly was talking about, I think that she called them forever beds. And it's instead of like after you get the crop, you're not like tilling it and like starting from scratch. You're adding on to it. And it like just really like enhances the like plant ecosystem or whatever. And I just remember thinking, wow, what a far way she has come from the girl who like had her little 4x4 plot and just like
plowed
as many tomatoes as she could, and it was just all overgrown,
really inefficient and messy,
right? Exactly. And when I was listening to her explain like this like forever plot thing, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like really intricate, like she knows what she's talking about, which I thought was really cool, just to see it kind of come full circle and just kind of like see the growth.
And with that, let's go into our interview with Molly from Earth Dance Farm.
Hi, Molly.
Hello.
Thanks for meeting with us today.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to finally get out here to your farm and see the land. Tell us a little bit of an introduction about how you ended up with this beautiful chunk of land and how many acres are here on this property.
Yeah. So this farm is about 14 acres. And I first visited this farm as a teenager. Actually, my dad brought me here as the nature-loving, vegetable-eating kid in the family. He grew up in Ferguson and knew of this place. And many winding roads between when I came as a teenager and when I came back as a young adult and started Earth Dance. But ultimately, I felt like this was really a gem of a farm. It's considered to be the oldest organic farm west of the Mississippi. And the farmers who grew food here were incredible farmers. They were really pioneers of the organic farming movement before that was even like a household word, the word organic. I wanted to ensure that this farm stayed in production.
So when you say oldest this side of the Mississippi, what does that mean?
Well, this farm was established by the Miller family in 1883. So, you know, and we are now certified organic. So we do, but of course, before there wasn't even the National Organic Program until about 1990. And so previously, it was just that it was stewarded in a way that was in keeping with organic principles. And this farm even predates when the city of Ferguson was established.
Amazing.
Yeah, those are some kind of astonishing historical facts.
So then, did you grow up around here, or how did you come in contact first with this property, I guess?
Or how did your dad know about it?
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, he grew up in Ferguson. He wasn't a lifelong resident. He did end up, he and my mom moved to Creve Coeur, which is primarily where I grew up. So I mostly grew up in West County, actually. But their first home was in Ferguson as a couple, and then they moved to Bellenor, which is near Normandy and Umsel. So I actually lived there for the first few years of my life, and then they relocated us to Creve Coeur. But my dad always kept his business up here. It's a screen printing company that still exists today called Sports Print. And so we would spend a lot of time as a family in Ferguson. And it's kind of hard to believe that I, just this one literal visit as a teenager, just left such a strong impression that I always wondered what was going to happen to this land when Al and Caroline passed on, because they did not have any children themselves. And so I was always concerned that it would just get sold and end up developed like the property around us. So,
sure.
Yeah.
So like, for those that don't know, you're speaking of different parts of St. Louis County is where you, right. where you grew up. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that as a teenager, you had a trip. Was it a school trip? Was it just your dad's acquaintance?
No, he just took me here. He's always been like a, what do they call them? Like a promoter, but there's another word for it. Like just somebody that just
enthusiast.
He's always been a huge enthusiast for the city and the community of Ferguson, having grown up here and having had his business here. And he was always looking for ways to bring people here and show them parts of the town that he was so proud to be from. And it's kind of funny because, of course, now, I mean, it's not funny at all, but it's interesting to me that now Ferguson is a town that is sometimes known internationally for something very different. But
sure.
Before 2014, a lot of people, even in St. Louis, weren't familiar with Ferguson and knew much about it. And so he just always had that hometown pride and was like a local booster for the place. Yeah, I do. This is not related to my origins here, but I do feel like it's important to also acknowledge before the Millers were even here, what we know of the nations of people who were on this land before even the Millers were either the Missouri, Osage, or Illini peoples. And unfortunately, we don't know a lot more history than that, specifically about this piece of property, because so many Native people were pushed through this land. And so, but we do think it's important to acknowledge that there was even pre-1883 people that spent time here and took care of this land.
I guess you said some of that's lost to history, but I mean, I know in the Cahokia tribes, they had a lot of different unique produce that they were growing. And I wonder if there was something here prior, maybe. As a teenager, did you have an interest in farming or agriculture or growing things?
Yeah. I was really the kid that loved nature, and I loved healthy eating and loved vegetables. So really that was, I would say, why my dad thought to bring me here, mm-hmm. because he knew that this organic vegetable farm existed. And so, and he had friends. He didn't ever work here as a teenager, but he had a lot of friends who grew up working here with the Millers. And so they used to hire a lot of kids from the area to help with the harvest. So
did your parents have a garden at home?
We had a small one. I would say my grandparents' garden was always more memorable than we definitely tried. You know, we grew some tomato plants, and I did get a family friend to help till up a patch of ground. And this was before I knew anything, of course, about how much you could put into a single like 4x4 plot. And it just quickly became a jungle. And I was like, oh, this is not very successful. And I think about that when I think about one of the programs that we offer now. So I should mention that Earth Ants is an organic farm school. So that makes our farm and our organization unique compared to a lot of other small scale vegetable farms, is that are just as much as focusing on growing really healthy food and stewarding the land, we are focused very much on education. And so, and that comes in a variety of shapes and sizes. And one of the ways that we do that is training gardeners, actually, because we've realized our longest running program is a farm apprenticeship program for people that are actually interested in agriculture, potentially as a career. But we learned that so many people were interested in learning these skills, but couldn't necessarily become full-time farmers and maybe wanted to do it more on a backyard scale. So now we have a spring training for gardeners program that actually just registration just opened on Thursday. If people want to have a more successful garden than I had as a teenager. Because I think that's a common experience is you're like, oh, this is easy. I'll just like till up some ground or, you know, make a raised bed and just plop some vegetable plants in and then
pull some weeds, water it.
Yeah. And, you know, forget about any pest issues or anything like that. So, yeah, this program is really designed to help people have a successful garden season.
So then, like, why the farm school element? I mean, you had an interest in farming as a teenager, growing things, but then what changed or to implement this learning arm of the farm or this mission to teach in conjunction with growing?
Right. Well, in addition to always being interested in healthy eating and nature and environmental stuff, I also have a passion for education. And so even going away to college, I knew that the type of education that I would want to do was outdoor and environmental education. So I majored in environmental studies, thinking that would be my path. And then realized that, like, in particular, agriculture was the combination of everything I was passionate about. And so I had the good fortune to be able to go to do an organic farming apprenticeship program in Santa Cruz, California. And at the time, there was nothing like that in Missouri. And so that was also one of the huge motivating factors of making this a farm school is certainly there were people like me from the Midwest who wanted to learn these skills, but maybe who didn't have the ability to go and, you know, work and live on a farm full time in California. A few years after that was when I got Earth Dance started here.
So that was post-college is when all of that started kind of trickling into place. What other, you do a lot with the community, not just through your educational programs, but through inviting school groups out and whatnot. Can you talk a little bit about some of the other fingers of opportunity that you're offering here at the farm beyond the gardener's class?
Yeah, absolutely. So we still are operating in a farm apprenticeship program to train new farmers. And then in addition to the spring training for gardeners program, we're also offering a lot of field trips and tours, like you said, and what we would call service learning. So lots of volunteer opportunities. The best way to learn for a lot of folks when it comes to farming and gardening is just to get your hands dirty and do it with us, do it in community. And then we have a really significant partnership with the Ferguson Florissant School District. So we call it the broad umbrella of farm to school. And so what that looks like is there's an internship program that we operate in partnership with a local high school down the street. We also go into the schools and do healthy cooking presentations. We have a really awesome educator, farm to school educator, Joya, on our team, who's actually has a chef background. She's taking what's fresh from the fields and takes the fresh mobile, as we call it, the mobile kitchen, into school classrooms and is teaching how you can incorporate these fresh vegetables into delicious food. And then we're hosting just a lot of groups out on the farm on a regular basis.
So it was like a Jamie Oliver element to this a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, so many, especially young people, so many people are drawn maybe to the eating side. And that's where, you know, that's where their entry point will be into caring more about where the food comes from. And so we see that, as, of course, especially with middle schoolers and high school students, that they're more interested in learning how to cook the food than necessarily growing it. But if you start there, then there might be an interest in, like, where can I even get this? Because you can't find a lot of these things at the grocery store. And so then when they start to see how it's grown and can be a part of how it's grown, it really flips the notion on its head that kids won't eat vegetables. It's like, no, if they have any interaction with it, and especially if they help grow it, they're going to want to taste everything.
Yeah. It's like a spark.
Yeah.
It really is kind of a ripple effect. Once some of those lines are drawn between a few of the dots, you can kind of see kids light up with interest and excitement. And when there's involvement or the seeing a whole plant come in and then seeing that plant transformed into a dish and then eating it, I can imagine how
powerful that is, you know, for somebody to observe. It's really neat that you're so implanted in the regional school area. That's a really beautiful thing for the community, enriching both ways.
Let's see, post-California, you studied abroad. Is that correct? And could you just go into that a little bit in terms of, like, you know, once you finished your program in California, why go the next step and why go abroad?
Well, I was able to study abroad as an undergrad, so it was actually before California.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. And I went to a small school in Florida, actually, for undergrad that really emphasized international exchange programs. And so I was really lucky that the scholarship that I had to attend my college could also transfer to studying overseas. So I spent a semester in Ghana, actually. And I felt like that was one of the places where, you know, growing up in the 80s, the kinds of commercials that you would see on TV for, like, helping starving children in Africa would have had me believe, or did have me believe, that, you know, there was just not enough food there, that there was, you know, it was drought stricken, or, you know, there was not enough production. But going and seeing firsthand the open air markets that were brimming with food, and then even going out into the further villages, it was really eye-opening to see that it was not at all a scarcity of food being produced. A lot of it has to do with things like post-harvest handling, is like the nerdy way to call it. I'm like, how can you prevent food spoilage? And how do you also ensure that distribution is equitable so that everyone can afford the food that you're producing?
Gotcha.
So,
yeah.
And there was a woman who I was introduced to during my college years that was writing about this very issue, that it's not a scarcity of food that we need to be concerned about. It's a scarcity of democracy. So reading she and her daughter's work, Frances Morlepe and Anna Lepe, their book, Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet, was like very eye-opening for me in college.
So that did that lead to more, would you say, an activist sort of frame of mind or view of things? Or I don't know, what would you consider that revelation, that it's not necessarily just growing and selling, it's a matter of much more involved with the complete supply chain?
Right, totally. I would say that really fanned the flames of my of my existing kind of activist mindset and, like, orientation towards social justice. I went to school in St. Louis through Catholic schools, and service and justice have always been a part, I felt like, of educational upbringing I had. But I also thought that going to college and actually getting exposed to, like, how these ideas kind of fit together, and, like, not necessarily thinking of things as simple as, like, charity and philanthropy, you know, but also like the economic factors at play and the sociopolitical climates that make change easier or keep people oppressed. You know, I mean, there are so many issues that come into play. And again, agriculture just feels like it's bound up in all those things.
So you have Ferguson, and you actually have a farm that is readily available for both learning and use of the nutritious food products that you make. And so you've essentially worked to tie that as close to a community as possible, without, you know, people think farms, they think, you know, out in the rural areas.
Right.
But, you know, driving in, this is, you know, pretty urban, suburban neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of access.
Yeah, I would add that healthy food access has become a significant part of what we do. So we've always wanted to be a part of the local farmers market. There's a really great Ferguson Farmers Market down the street. So for 15 years and counting, we've been a vendor there. And then we've also, just in the last few years, added to the farm a pay what you can farm stand. So we actually converted an old tool shed and renovated it to become our farm stand, and completely made our pricing model, distribution model, I guess what you say, for the farm stand and the Ferguson Farmers Market, both all pay what you can. So things are still priced with a retail price, because a lot of people are like, just tell me how much I owe. You know, I just want to know what this is like. I don't want to have to guess what your fair market value is. So then at checkout, people will be told, okay, the retail value is this. And then we flip the screen to them and they tell us what they can pay. You know, we're finding more and more people, sadly, because food insecurity is actually on the rise, are needing to take a discount. And so for people who are in a position to pay more, that's wonderful. And those donations really help us offset that. But that's an example of a reason why it helps to be a nonprofit doing this kind of work, because we can ask for donations and get grants and things like that to support this kind of work. So I do acknowledge that this is, again, a difference between being a farm, a small scale, maybe family vegetable farm, and a farm that we're really driven by the education and the social mission.
That's outstanding. Yeah. So you have like this hierarchy of wanting people to learn, investment in the community, and also you have organic produce that is grown and harvested and distributed.
Yeah, I wish it didn't have to be that. You know, I just said that about being a nonprofit farm, and I'm like, I don't want to make it at all sound like it's better than being a for-profit farm, because I also feel like farmers should be able to make a living and make a profit growing in this way and even distributing in this way. But sadly, it's, you know, if you're also simultaneously wanting to have the farmers paid a living wage, we are in this place in history where the food is undervalued. And so we need to actually supplement it with donations and grants.
When in the first few years that you were here with Earth Dance Farms, did you encounter any hardships or problems in the beginning? Smooth sailing.
Oh, God.
I wondered, it's always intriguing to, you know, kind of, well, and inspiring to hear how, you know, people get through, you know, things and conquer some of those obstacles in the beginning, because everybody's got their own sets of battles. And I imagine yours is maybe a little different and unique because you are more of a suburban farmer.
Uh-huh.
We've traveled to a lot that are kind of outside city limits, and you don't see people and there are no stoplights. So it's kind of an interesting setting that you have.
Gosh, yeah. I'm trying to think of what to start with. I mean, one of the most significant barriers early on was that we were on a single year lease. And so growing any kind of crops, but in particular vegetables that require irrigation, pretty much without working irrigation, we were literally filling up 55-gallon drums with garden hose water from my house, which is a mile and a half away. So we would put these drums in somebody's pickup truck and drive it over to my house, take probably half an hour to fill those up with water, and then bring them back and plunge watering cans into them to then go water the, you know, 200-foot rows of vegetables. Wouldn't recommend it ever. I think it's...
It worked.
Well, God is done.
It was pretty foolish, to be honest. Looking back, I'm like, I would not recommend bootstrapping as hard as we did. But, you know, I think that's where youth comes into play, is you're like, okay, you know, you just work more hours and put in more sweat and you get it done. But it was, and it, you know, it was almost comical to the degree to which we tried to make do with very, very little. But yeah, I mean, our startup money for the very first season was $5,000 to grow an acre of vegetables was our goal, which that does not go very far, even for something that you might think doesn't cost that much. But there's just a lot of upfront costs of tools and equipment and seeds themselves. Because of, again, of being certified organic, we are only sourcing certified organic seed. And that is... can be 50% higher at times than regular seed cost. So, or I shouldn't say regular, than conventional seed cost, yeah.
And did you jump right into a CSA style operation or?
Yeah, that was a challenge too. We grew the CSA a little bit too quickly. And so our third year, we went from, okay, we're gonna lease an acre in 2009 and let's do 2 acres in 2010. Let's do 4 acres in 2011. And it was just too much to manage. We did have a tractor, but it was a used tractor. None of us have tractor mechanic experience, so it was frequently not working. And we had sold 100 CSA shares that third year. And it was really challenging to give everybody a decent share of the veggies that year and to have variety and the things that, you know, customers are used to having when you get produce all year long. You don't want the same exact thing. You know, you get tired of the kale and the collards week after week. So So we did do a CSA model. We no longer do that as our own farm. Now we're actually part of a few different combined CSA models. CSA standing for Community Supported Agriculture, where people buy into the farm and, you know, they may pay up front is usually what happens. And then they get a share of the harvest each week. So there's a few local people that are running it as like a combined CSA where they actually source from multiple local farms. And then people can get a wider variety that way. So we're part of those.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Would you say first couple of years starting up, was your challenge finding enough people to help? Or, I mean, were you trying to do the education off the bat as well? How'd you start that up? I mean, that's...
Yeah, it was really kind of a wish and a prayer. I feel like, and especially the first season without any track record, I mean, I didn't know that many people in St. Louis, even though I grew up here, especially people that necessarily were into this kind of thing. And so I don't even remember how we got the word out that first season. It was like...
This was 2000, you said 2009?
2009 was the first year of programming. Yeah, 2008 was when we had our first fundraiser and made a documentary about the history of the farm.
So at least it wasn't as bad as like posting a... you know, pull tab at a coffee shop, say like, hey, interested in farming?
Did that actually?
Okay.
Like, no, that's actually flyering coffee shops and flyering the libraries. And because I think we may have had a MySpace page or something.
Sure, yeah.
It was definitely before Facebook was as prolific as it is now. And, but yeah, we used whatever social media we could, but it was a lot of like, flyering and word of mouth, and we had info sessions about, so you want to be a farmer, here's what the program entails. And I did have the farm apprenticeship program that I had done, which was a full-time program, but it did give me a lot of ideas to draw from in terms of like how to set up the program and what to include. Yeah, those first years, it was amazing. We had 15 people enroll the first season, and it was a 9-month program, so that was even longer than it is now. And it was, we had 12 finish it, 12 out of 15. And then the second year, we had 30 people participate.
So you doubled.
Yeah, more than. For the number of people that finished it, even more than. Yeah, the challenges also, though, of not having land security were very real. And so not knowing, you know, if we were going to be here from year to year, it made it much more challenging to invest not only in working irrigation, but also doing things like putting in fruit trees and putting in things that have a longer return on your investment, putting up a high tunnel, you know, things like that, putting in a packing shed. So, and Caroline at the time still lived here. Her husband, Al, had passed away when we were first leasing the land. And then I guess it was in the fall of 2010 that she passed away. Caroline passed away. And so then for pretty much all of 2011, we weren't sure if we were going to be able to stay here. So we were actually looking at other properties to move the program to. But then in 2012, May of 2012, we were able to close on the farm and buy the farm from her family. And so that made a huge difference in terms of being able to really plan long term for this place and for what we do.
And a sense of security. I would imagine that brought a great sense of calm and a confidence to continue propelling yourself forward and getting more implanted and involved.
More infrastructure.
Yeah, the critical things that help you more in the long run, that I'm sure that made a massive difference.
And I would say that's a really common challenge for a lot of urban farmers is lack of land security, because a lot of rural farms are often, you know, in the family for generations before somebody buys it. If somebody does, is able to acquire it as, you know, first generation farmers, then that's also amazing. But it's also, you know, a huge loan to take out or other things. So being able to actually secure the land for the long term is something that I feel extremely honored and humbled that we're able to have, you know, ownership. And it's funny because, of course, even that I'm like struggle with using that term because I believe more in stewardship than necessarily private ownership. But it's what makes it feasible to make long-term decisions for your space. And so any urban farmer who is, you know, maybe on an LRA lot in the city, you know, if they don't know if they're going to be able to lease the same parcel the following year, you're really limited in terms of what you want to invest and what you can invest on that piece of ground.
I feel like it would be like working with your brakes on, like your foot is on the brake pedal the whole time. Kind of, I would be paranoid and concerned. Who helped like with the purchasing from the family? Was it a collective group of people willing to help and invest?
Yeah, we were very fortunate that we had a few folks who stepped forward and kind of knew a little bit about the situation of the challenge of not knowing if we were going to be here from year to year. And yeah, put up a challenge grant. And then we were also partnering with the Open Space Council, which is actually an environmental nonprofit in the region that's focused on conserving land and water resources. And they also do land trust work. And so they saw this as a way of securing green space in the region. So they actually matched the challenge grant. And then some other donors stepped forward and said, we want y'all to own the farm outright. So it was incredible, the collective effort that made that possible. And then so many, like we just walked around the farm, so many of the pieces of infrastructure that you've seen have totally been through, you know, made possible by so many people being generous to help this place thrive. Yeah.
I mean, we've been fortunate enough to help and support your Farmers Formal for a couple of years now. And is that one of your main yearly sources of revenue?
It definitely is. Yeah. Farmers Formal has been a huge deal for us for many years, actually. We, of course, during the pandemic, we didn't host major events for a few years, but we brought it back a few years ago, and it's really raises probably 25% to 30% of our operating revenue for the year. And there's even been years it's been more than that. So it's a very substantial event for us. It takes a lot of, you know, time and effort and planning and a lot of people who are generous to support it, like you all. But yeah, we're actually hoping to make it an every other year event, mostly because of how much time and energy it takes. And so it then pulls away from like the other programs that we do. We don't want to, you know, and so we're hoping to start doing this year. We will definitely be having Farmers Formal, I should say, September 13th, mark your calendars. Yeah, after this year, we're hoping we can afford to do it every other year so that in those off years, we can maybe have a smaller event on the farm to introduce more people to where, you know, where we're located and see what we have in action. But yeah, that's a huge way that people have supported us over the last 15 years.
Beautiful. Very encouraging. What can you tell us a little bit about the variety of veggies, fruits, or just like do you have a general number you can spit out? Like annually we have...
You know, many I used to have a spreadsheet that had every single variety that we're growing in it.
It's probably easier to talk about 10 years ago. Now you've grown and expanded greatly. And
yeah, our farm team, I'm not in all the crop planning meetings anymore.
Sure.
But I will say it's got to be at least 60 unique varieties of fruits and veggies, but it's probably a lot more than that. Because when you think about just tomatoes alone, we're probably growing 8 to 10 varieties of tomatoes and 4 varieties of radishes and 2 to 3 varieties of beets. And I mean, greens is like a whole huge category. But yeah, there's a lot of things that we're growing our annual vegetable crops, but then we are also growing a huge variety of fruit. We do have about a 200 tree fruit orchard that's dispersed across the land. So the types of fruits that we're growing are things that are as suitable as possible for growing in this region. So actually Asian pears grow really well here, and pawpaws, of course, because they're a native fruit to this region. We're growing apples and European pears and plums and peaches and tart cherries and juneberries and mulberries and trying to think of some of the other perennial fruits, gooseberries, currants.
That's quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, I'm impressed. Yeah. That's enough. Right. Plus, you have an herb garden as well.
Yeah. The herb garden is, what do you call it, like a labor of love by multiple volunteers who really just want to give back to the community by growing things that are not only used for culinary purposes, but also medicinal. And so one of the main herb garden leaders, Kathleen, even led a workshop last fall for people to make their own fire cider using herbs that we grew here, including even horseradish root, which is one of the key ingredients of fire cider.
Yeah, for those that don't know what fire cider is, would you be able to give a basic overview?
Sure. I mean, it's I guess I would call it folk medicine at its finest. It's made with apple cider vinegar as the vinegar base, and then ingredients that people will steep in the vinegar are horseradish root, garlic cloves, turmeric, ginger root, jalapeno peppers or other kinds of peppers, onions. Did I mention those already? And then people will choose different herbs. Everyone kind of has their own different recipe of what they want to put into it. But then you let it steep in the vinegar in a jar for 2 to 4 weeks, and then you can strain it out and take a spoonful of that strong tasting vinegar all winter long. And the idea is that it really keeps colds and flu at bay.
Nice. Okay. Thank you.
It's a health tonic, I guess, would have been a shorter version of calling it.
Yeah. Herbalism, which we've dabbled at that term with some of our farmers too. How many volunteers are you getting to visit here weekly or monthly in your prime growing season? What's kind of a general format, number, outlook, regulars, not regulars? What's your core farm team that you have here, like paid crew staff? I'm just kind of curious to hear more about the army that you have, because it is a nice bit of property to handle, and you've got a lot of rows and hoop houses to deal with.
Yeah. So the total staff team of Earth Dance is currently 14 people.
Wow.
Yeah. And out of those 14 folks, there's 3 who are full-time farmers. So in addition, the other folks do things like everything from the What's Fresh initiative, like I mentioned earlier, that goes where we have people going into schools, to doing outreach events in the community, to managing the Pay What You Can farm stand, to doing bookkeeping, fundraising. There's a whole slew of marketing. There's a whole slew of activities that support the programs and the farming that we do. In addition to those 3 full-time staff farmers, we also, this season, are going to have 2 full-season apprentices, and they're each going to work about 30 hours a week and really get a deep immersion into what's entailed in small-scale vegetable growing. And then in addition, we'll do a summer apprenticeship program for people who have a shorter span of time they can commit to do the summer, spend their summer here, or at least, 10 to 20 hours a week here. And then there's a lot of folks who are either recent retirees or, just want to come out and volunteer as they're available. And we have, I believe it's 3 or 4 shifts a week that we invite the public to come out and volunteer. And so on a given harvest day, we may have 3 volunteers or we may have 12, it really depends on the day. But we do have a really solid, amazing crew of some regulars that have made this like their second home. So
have you heard what they're doing in, I think, Denmark or Netherlands? They're having agriculture or small scale farming as therapy for a lot of folks.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing.
So a lot of people are finding a good, positive, antidepressant response from working the soil and, weeding and volunteering at some small farms out. I'm pretty sure it's Denmark.
It completely makes sense.
Yeah.
I will say some of our volunteers literally tell us that is why they come back, is that this is therapeutic for them. And so I'm not surprised at all. There's a part of the soil that has the same properties as the active ingredient in Prozac. And so literally you can think of like your hands going into the soil.
Antidepressant.
Is a natural antidepressant. Really is. I mean, I feel it myself because I've often in meetings or, behind a computer screen for a lot of my work day. And if I go take a farm walk and go join the crew for a little bit of time, I'm just like, it's an instant upper for me. It's like really incredible the effect that it can have on our mental health. So I'm delighted that people are making that much more of a direct connection. And I think that's the way humans are wired. We are wired to like be physically active and do things with other humans that are having productive outcomes. So it's like to do something that feels that tangible, but also that you're getting fresh air and sun and like in our case, there's a lot of other people around. So people also are developing new friendships and building that sense of community while they're here. It's very palpable, the feeling of people getting a lift by being here.
And like a return volunteer or somebody that's coming out here regularly from the community, they'd get to see, you know, end products through the year. And that's a very gratifying experience too, to see a beginning, a middle, the sort of maintenance, weeding, caretaking, therapy going on there. And then also finally an end product that maybe you get to visually enjoy and
eat
and ingest. Yeah. And like it's a full circle.
Yeah, volunteers.
Beautiful experience.
We're all here. Yeah. They take home lots of veggies and, you know, it's exciting just to hear what they make with everything. And sometimes even people bring things in to share with the other volunteers then, like, you know, try this carrot cake I made or whatever it may be. Yeah.
So we were talking about the soil and your Prozac dirt. We always like to hear what kind of your tricks are with your soil. You obviously have a very conscientious, regenerative, organic, certified approach. So what are your composting techniques or your general soil care? What are you sure to keep in your compost? Or what do you like to add? Or
yeah,
everybody's got their own sort of ratios and recipes, but just a general talk on that is always fun to hear.
Yeah. Well, speaking of compost, we do on-farm composting. So that is definitely part of our practice. Of course, with our scale, it is actually even not enough. So we're often buying in compost to supplement in the beds. So adding compost is a huge element because that is the thing that literally increases the percentage of organic matter in the soil. And organic matter is what holds the carbon and is what is literally the building blocks for the soil organisms that make up the soil life. And so we are, you know, a lot of people, when they hear that you're farming organically, they think of what you're not doing, that you're not spraying pesticides, chemical pesticides, or using synthetic fertilizers. But I like to try to emphasize what we are doing, which is primarily focusing on the health of the soil. And so in addition to adding compost and building compost, we're also using permanent beds, which is actually a way of maintaining the integrity of, again, that soil habitat for that the life of the soil. Because if you think about it, every time that you go in and till, it's kind of like a hurricane wipes through the soil life's homes and, you know, obliterates it. They have to rebuild. So instead, if you're building on top of that and adding new layers to the soil, that is going to keep everything happier underground. So some ways that we do use permanent beds are once we have them built, then we're really trying to keep the same path between the beds rather than, again, creating new beds and new paths with a tiller. But we're also adding things like mulch on top or straw or leaf litter. Those are all things that can not only add more organic matter, but can also keep the soil moisture levels good because we're not seeing as much evaporative loss. We also, when we try to minimize how much bare soil is showing, because not only does that prevent erosion, but we're also having living cover on the soil is one of the best ways to keep the soil fed because the organisms are feeding off of the roots of whatever is growing in there. Those are like the major like highways that are bringing down different nutrients to the soil life. So that means having cover crops are often what we will grow in areas that we're not actively growing vegetables. So instead of actually leaving a field just bare after, we'll leave the remains of whatever vegetable that was grown there and whatever wasn't harvested from the fields, we'll let that decompose in place. We'll even often tarp it so that it'll help accelerate the decomposition. And then we will often have fields that are all in cover crops. So cover crops are something that not only can you grow it to have living cover, but it's also to minimize weed pressure so that, you know, again, if we left it bare, weeds would come up. Nature does not want bare soil. And it also is a way of decreasing compaction so that more roots are going into the ground and again, creating that different highway system underground that gets everything to where it needs to go. So, and crop rotation is another practice that a lot of farmers use, including us, which means we're not growing tomatoes in the same field year after year, because that's going to deplete that one particular field of certain nutrients. We're rotating where things go.
Sounds like a good operation and a good learning experience for a lot of folks new to farming, and especially those who want to advance their agricultural careers or backyard prowess, I would say.
Backyard prowess, indeed. How many farm schools are there now? I mean, because you experienced the one in California a short few years ago. Do you know? I mean, I guess that would have been an interesting thing to look up, but I'm just curious. I mean, in the Midwest,
That's a great question. I don't know that there's like one directory that you can find them all, right? To be honest. Yeah. It's
where is your cohort?
Right. There is a really great group out of Vermont that is called the Farm-Based Education Network. And they're a network of not just farm schools, but organizations that do, just like it sounds, farm-based education. And so I don't know how many people are in that network, but again, not every organization that does it will necessarily be part of it. But it's been exciting to see how much even the urban agriculture landscape and the farm education landscape has changed here in St. Louis. I mean, when we were getting started, there was, formerly known as Gateway Greening, now Seed St. Louis, they were a community gardening organization. So they taught garden scale, but there weren't really many other organizations dedicated to teaching anything about agriculture. And so, now there's a few different organizations doing apprenticeship programs and gardening and farming training. So I think the demand has increased.
Which is great. I mean, what's it called? The rising tides in the ships?
Yeah.
So more
rising
more,
tide raises all ships.
Yeah, so there's more schools, more people will be learning about it. And you have better access that you were mentioning earlier, more understanding of the importance of agriculture and its relationship with health.
Well, also, it corresponds beautifully with the growth in regional and local farmers' markets, too. I mean,
they
have expanded exponentially
in general, totally,
which is exciting.
There's a great array of culinary, restaurants in St. Louis, St. Louis region. And do you guys, serve any of those?
We do. We do sell to some restaurants. Yeah. In fact, that has been a huge part of the local food movement, I would say, over the years, is increasing the prioritization of sourcing from local farms. Like, I would say chefs have often been at the forefront of that. And then, eventually some grocery stores caught on, and that's great. And farmers markets, of course, have expanded as a result of more and more shoppers and more farmers wanting to have that level of
direct connection.
Yeah. So we do sell to some restaurants. As we see more demand for the pay what you can farm stand and at the Ferguson Farmers Market, it's kind of like this graph where it's like we'll see less going to restaurants. And thankfully, there's a lot of other farmers that are able to service restaurant accounts. And so we can serve more and more of our local community. But currently, we definitely are still serving or servicing some restaurant accounts as well as some local grocery stores. Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen your produce at City Greens.
City Greens Market.
As well. Local Harvest.
Sometimes. Yep. Yeah. And then Fair Shares is one of the combined CSAs that we supply. So yeah, it's been great to work with all these.
Oh, that's what CCSA stands for, combined.
Uh-huh.
I was like, what is that, a C?
What's the extra C for?
For Fair Shares?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you a Fair Shares member?
I do procure some things from Fair Shares, yes.
Awesome.
And actually, folks can find our hummus on there as well.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Cool. That's really good to know. For folks that are interested in volunteering, of course, they just go to your website.
Yeah. In fact, we have even a sign up for our monthly volunteer orientation. So we'll be kicking those off in March. And we do ask if you have never volunteered here before to come and take an orientation. That'll give you a tour and help you understand what's going on. And then there's also opportunities to volunteer, even if you can't come to an orientation. We have a monthly hoppy hour event, which is really fun. It's basically an hour of pulling hop vine, which is an invasive on the farm, followed by some hoppy drinks to drink. So
that sounds like a hoppy hour.
Yeah, there's some fun ways to get involved here for sure.
Nice. And it's earthdance.com?
earthdancefarms.org.
Earthdancefarms.org.
Yeah.
All right.
You can find us also on Instagram and Facebook and YouTube.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much. Is there anything that we didn't ask that you'd want us to ask or that you wanted to share with the audience?
Yeah, anything else on your mind that you'd like to color in where you're like, oh, this is a big piece of the puzzle they didn't ask about or I didn't get a chance to touch on?
You did a really comprehensive job with it all. You even mentioned Farmers Formal, which I appreciate. So, yeah.
Yeah, so, well, thank you so much, Molly, for having us out to your farm. It's been a pleasure.
Yes. Thank you for the time and the tour.
Yeah.
It's beautiful to finally get our eyes on the space where all of the delicious produce is coming from.
You can follow along with Earth Dance Farms and their farm school adventures at earthdancefarms.org and on social media, Earth Dance Farms.
Sign up for a class. Volunteer.
Go get your hands in the dirt. You'll feel better.
It's therapeutic, I hear.
Vitamin D.
That's right.
Yeah, this has been a Tangled Taproot production of Milk and Hummus.